Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. John Halamka, Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School, advancing technologies that will facilitate true personalized medicine through wearables, genomics, artificial intelligence, and health IT. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with John Halamka, Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess and Harvard Medical School.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Halamka, emergency room physician, chief information officer since 1998 at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and international healthcare innovation professor at the Harvard Medical School, where he oversees all educational research and administrative computing for 18,000 faculty and 3,000 students. He's also chairman of the New England Healthcare Exchange Network and is co-chair of the HIT Standards Committee. Dr. Halamka writes extensively on health information technology in his popular blog, Life as a Healthcare CIO, and recently published Blockchain in Healthcare Today. He earned his Bachelor's of Science at Stanford, his medical degree from UC San Francisco School of Medicine, and his MS at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Halamka, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you as well. And you recently launched this new venture called Health Technology Exploration Center, which is seeking to leverage emerging technologies like artificial intelligence, telemedicine, blockchain in the healthcare industry. It sounds like a very exciting sandbox to play in. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners about the new incubator center and your plans to bring some of these tech innovations more rapidly to scale.
Well, absolutely. And so having been in the Harvard system for 25 years, what you see is an ultimate learning laboratory. Thousands of faculty and wonderful students, patients and data, and a sense that we need to make healthcare better. And you see today in private industry, wonderful technologies, deep learning and mobile and cloud. But very often, these larger companies don't have the domain expertise to actually test out their products in real healthcare environments and make sure they're useful to doctors and patients. And so this notion of the Health Technology Exploration Center is to provide that learning laboratory. It's not as if we're going to create technologies to sell to the outside world. It's taking technologies from the outside world and bringing them into a lab.
Well, Dr. Halamka, you've said that if data interoperability is to improve, then the standards have to improve first. And as the co-chair of the HIT Standards Committee, you've said there are three key areas where we should be able to meaningfully improve those standards in health IT. I wonder if you could share those with us on what you've learned through your experience developing standards within your network, as well as working with the top standard experts around the world, and which standards you see as having the power to improve health data liquidity as well as data intelligence.
So the whole standards process is a journey. And remember, standards are built by consensus. So that means a vote of 1,000 to 1 is a tie. So it can be very challenging to get international consensus. So as I've worked over the last 15 years on these particular issues, I've tried to move us from what used to be something healthcare very specific and slightly arcane to something that would be more the standards that a Google or an Amazon would use to create an ecosystem of products. And so what do I mean by this? Well, today, if you're an engineer working with a Google or Amazon environment, you're using a set of standards called the JavaScript Object Notation, or JSON. And that particular technique has now been incorporated into healthcare data interoperability using the Argonaut project. Now, the Argonaut project basically says we're going to take the common kinds of data you use in healthcare, problems and meds and allergies and labs, and make it so easy that a 26-year-old in their garage without healthcare domain expertise can write novel apps. But there must be security. And so in addition to those kinds of standards that make data flow, there are certain kinds of standards, OAuth and OpenID, that help us with security and making sure that only the right actors get access to your data. And then finally, we continue to work on vocabularies. When I say high blood pressure, hypertension, and elevated blood pressure, they all mean the same thing. But yet we need to make sure that our data flows such that we actually understand what data we receive based on what the doctor or patient meant.
You know, I've been thinking about the change that we've witnessed since the passage of the HITECH Act, which allowed many members of our healthcare system to switch from paper to electronic health records in a fairly short time. And with every gift comes sort of an obligation, and the obligation here was to meet the standards of meaningful use. And you've said that it's placed too heavy a burden on clinicians who are overwhelmed by data requirements in their daily workflows. You say we're data rich, but the data lacks wisdom, and that to spur innovation that is truly going to be helpful, we need to scale back on some of the regulatory restrictions and let the market drive the next wave of innovation. I was also sort of thinking as you were talking about creating this innovation center, we've sort of developed in our own Weizmann Institute sort of the law of inverse proportion to clicks. The more clicks that are required, the less adoption there's going to be. So you really have in your incubator system a novel approach to look at how health clinicians think about it. But also you're looking across the country in terms of these regulatory requirements that have been foisted upon the healthcare industry, and you're quite concerned about it. Talk to us about that.
Well, certainly. And so let me just tell you how it happened, because these are well-meaning people trying their very best. So as I was chairing these committees in Washington, let's imagine the FDA says, we're very concerned about implants, pacemakers, and things with batteries that fail. So we better, at every visit, have a doctor key in a universal device identifier for whatever implants you have. And all of us said, wow, that sounds great. And then the Centers for Disease Control says, Ebola is bad. We said, yeah, absolutely. And so therefore, we better document your travel history on every single encounter. And we said, okay, that's fine. Well, and before you know it, at the end of all of these deliberations, we ended up with 140 data elements that every clinician must record on every encounter while seeing a patient in 12 minutes, being empathetic, and never committing malpractice. It's not possible. Yep. So hence this sense that we need better technology that isn't just more clicks. I mean, I'll make up something here. What if Alexa, with appropriate security, you know, listened to what a doctor and patient said and then recorded a chart? Okay, well, that would reduce burden. Or what if we recognize that there are certain technologies emerging, natural language processing, that can help us look at text and get data from text, so there are fewer clicks and fewer checkboxes and things for doctors to enter? I mean, this is the sort of direction we need to go in, getting to a result without having to tell the doctors how to do it, giving the vendors the latitude to innovate.
Well, Dr. Halamka, another dimension of what is just so fascinating and exciting these days is certainly genomics. And I understand that your genome was only the second to be fully sequenced by the Human Genome Project. I believe you're known as patient number two. That's quite a distinction. But as we strive towards more personalized medicine with efforts such as the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative at NIH or Faster Cures or the Cancer Moonshot, describe the importance of the role of genomics and how you envision the healthcare system will have to be reimagined as genomics becomes much more completely integrated and entrenched in the delivery of healthcare.
We often hear these terms used today, personalized medicine and precision medicine. Well, let me distinguish between those two for a moment. So I am a 56-year-old male. Now, if you read the New England Journal, what it says is stop doing prostate-specific antigen testing on 56-year-old males because the last 10 years have not shown a reduction in sickness or death because of all this money we're spending. But my genome suggests that I'm going to die of prostate cancer someday. So wait a minute. For me, absolutely do that every year. So that's a bit more precise. So I hope that as we move forward with more and more people getting sequenced, the care plans are not just you're a 56-year-old male, but it's here's what your genome says your risks are, and therefore this is what we're going to do.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Halemka, Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and International Healthcare Innovation Professor at the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Halemka, you're a big proponent of telemedicine, which is starting to gain traction as payers increase their willingness to reimburse providers for such service. I note that CMS has proposed that the 2019 physician fee schedule allow for the billing of telemedicine. And so we see this starting to gain traction, and yet you say there are still challenges when it comes to clinicians practicing across state lines. And you say the fastest route to realizing telemedicine promises to facilitate the clinician-to-clinician connection. And we are very engaged in our own institution in e-consults, which are trying to connect those physicians together. And I think you have said very eloquently that it saves time, it reduces cost, it improves outcomes in most cases. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the power of telemedicine as we imagine a more high-functioning health system, and how do we scale it up across the country to all regions within the country?
So a few thoughts. So I do 900 telemedicine consultations a year. I am credentialed by Harvard to practice telemedicine, telecare, and malpractice insured. And what do? I am the nation's expert on poisonous mushrooms and plants. And so whenever a child or an adult has a poisonous mushroom or plant problem, poison control gets involved, I get typically an image sent to my iPhone. Here is the plant, here is the mushrooms, here is the symptom. And then I will say, ah, that is this particular variety, this is the toxidrome, this is the solution, and we treat the patient. But here's a challenge. I am licensed to practice in Massachusetts. I have been licensed to practice in California. What if I suggest that a medication needs to be given immediately, but I'm not licensed to practice in the state where the medication is given? And so this is where we just need to work on the regulatory framework. Can I use my Massachusetts licensure to ensure a medication is given in North Dakota? Well, at the moment, no. At the moment, that's where it's a provider-to-provider consultation, and the person who's licensed in North Dakota actually gives the medication. But think about it. At low cost, in real time, you're getting to the nation's expert with the best advice.
Wow.
And that is clearly something we want to do more of.
Well, that is really fascinating. Yet another dimension of your broad portfolio. I want to touch on another aspect of your work. As we've noted, you're the International Healthcare Innovation Professor at Harvard. And as such, you're traveling the globe and you're looking for and coming in contact with disruptive innovations in care delivery. And then you get to come back to that giant talent pool in Cambridge of students who are an incredibly tech-savvy generation that's increasingly globally and digitally connected. Tell us about the kind of innovations you've brought back to your students at Harvard that look exciting and promising to you.
So when you work in countries like Scotland or the Nordic countries, Denmark or Sweden, what you see is a whole new range of possibilities. So here we have 330 million people in the United States, but you go to Scotland, there are five. How many emergency department databases are there in the entire country of Scotland? One. And so if you go to an emergency department, every doctor in every emergency department immediately knows who you are, what medications you're on, what allergies you have, what laboratories you have. And so you look at these smaller countries and their agility and the ability to create data liquidity, and you say, can't we do this here? Or another example, if you were born in Norway today, you know, what would your medical record number be? It turns out it's 2018-0813-0001. It's a date plus a birth order. And every citizen has their entire record for life consolidated around a single number. And imagine the power for both care and analytics of doing that. So these are the sorts of things, technology and policy, you see that you say, I wish the United States would have as well.
Well, I do want to reflect on your expertise on mushrooms. I'm going to have to give up my Mushroom ID North America app, and I will just call on you. But, you know, you really, as I said earlier, have this incredible sandbox that you're engaged in. You're intellectually restless. And, you know, you're sort of at this intersection of so many of these emerging trends, the use of wearables, fitness trackers. You've talked about the voice activation power, perhaps, of an Alexa and the sort of remote monitoring capabilities that we have. But you're also increasingly engaged in the work and the capability of blockchain technology to safely share all of that data. And you've just launched a new publication, Blockchain in Healthcare Today. We had Samir Devani on talking about blockchain technology, but still it's something that I think mystifies many of us in terms of how it will work in the healthcare system. And wondering, how do you envision all of these technologies, including blockchain and the others, serving as game changers in the healthcare landscape as we move forward?
And so let's just quickly talk about blockchain. So blockchain's a public ledger, right? It's not owned by a corporation. It's not owned by a government. And it cannot be changed. Think of it as a blackboard where you can write once and never erase. So ask yourself, where can that kind of technology be helpful? Well, what if a patient sues a doctor and the attorney says, give me the medical record? Well, the attorney may say, oh, that medical record's been altered or changed. Well, it turns out we could use blockchain as a means of hosting what we'll call not the medical record itself, but an extract of the medical record. We call this a hash, a one-way mathematical transformation that can actually prove the medical record has never been altered or changed. So blockchain's great for audit trails. Blockchain might be a good place to store patient consent. I'm not putting my medical record on the blockchain, but here are my consent preferences on this public ledger that is unalterable. And we could all consult that ledger whenever your medical record is exchanged. So some good possibilities. On Internet of Things, on connected devices, I think increasingly as we move away from fee-for-service to pay-for-value, you're going to get more home care. And we've already talked a bit about telemedicine and telecare. So getting information from your home, what's your blood pressure, what's your pulse, what's your glucose, how's your sleep, and using that with your consent to keep you healthy in your home instead of treating you once you're already sick is incredibly important. So yes, in my home, my sleep is monitored, my weight is monitored, my blood pressure is monitored, and all that data is sent to my clinician and used as part of my total care program.
Well, Dr. Halamka, one more sort of look at the future. You've said that the need for inpatient hospital care is going to drop dramatically in the coming decades, and that we'll have to start thinking about how we're going to repurpose all those hospital beds and very sophisticated organizations for a different use in the future. Tell us what you're seeing in that vision.
Sure. So I'm an emergency physician. And so, of course, you're going to need emergency departments and ICUs for people who have heart attacks or strokes or get hit by cars. But the kinds of treatments we're delivering in what I'll call the ward beds, the standard unmonitored part of the hospital, can absolutely be delivered in the home. Why do we need you in a hospital if you're just getting a dose of antibiotics a day or a couple of medications to reduce the amount of water in your body if you have congestive heart failure? That sort of thing can be delivered in the home with appropriate monitoring. And so I can imagine the organizations of the future will have virtualists. These are individual clinicians that are monitoring patients in their homes using appropriate technology and ensuring the kind of interventions are made that would have been made in a hospital bed. So we'll have emergency departments, ICUs, and virtualists.
Well, that's very exciting. You know, I wonder if you could just pull the thread a little on, we talked a little earlier about the Alexas in the world. Are you doing any work in that area? Do you know of anybody who's doing work both to support patients, support clinicians, or is it still too new of an emerging field?
Well, should we try something a little dangerous?
Please.
Alexa, ask BIDMC, what is my care plan for today?
I'm not sure.
Ah, well, here, you know, I must have been a little too close with the phone and the mic. We've done 30 Alexa skills. And those are such things as, you know, when's my next dose of medication? When will my doctor see me? Get a nurse, these sorts of things. And they work really quite well. But Alexa at the moment isn't covered by a business associate agreement. Amazon does, by the end of the year, plan to have business associate agreement coverage so you can actually transmit protected healthcare information over Alexa. But for the moment, you know, the experiments we have done really aren't transferring things like your name or things that would be used to personally identify you. And so we probably are safe with the early experiments. But huge potential for the technology.
Let's try Alexa one more time. It may have just been just waking up.
Sure. Alexa, ask BIDMC, what's my care plan for today?
Your care plan for today includes, at 8 a.m., a blood test to measure glucose level and blood count. At 1:30 p.m., an x-ray. At 4:45 p.m., your doctor will be checking in.
Well, there you go.
Well, that is perfect. That is a great utility.
Absolutely. We've been speaking today with Dr. John Halamka, Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and International Healthcare Innovation Professor at the Harvard Medical School. You can learn more about his work by going to his blog, Life as a Healthcare CIO, at geekdoctor.blogspot.com, and follow him on Twitter at jhalamka. Dr. Halamka, thank you so much for your contributions to advancing health information technology, for your creativity and your enthusiasm for the future, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Senator Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic nominee for New York's 14th Congressional District seat, are pointing to a study they say shows Medicare for All would save Americans money. But the author says those comments appear to show a misunderstanding of his study. The study is based on the language of a Medicare for All bill proposed by Sanders last year that makes assumptions about reduced administrative and drug costs, as well as deeply reduced reimbursement rates to healthcare providers under a universal healthcare system. But the study's author believes those assumptions about savings are unrealistic. The study is a working paper written by Charles Blahaus of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. The center gets some of its funding from the libertarian Koch brothers, and Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez both reference that in their claims. The top line of the paper's abstract says that Sanders' Medicare for All bill, quote, would, under conservative estimates, increase federal budget commitments by approximately $32.6 trillion during its first 10 years of full implementation. But that's what the government would spend, not total healthcare expenditures. Sanders' office points to other figures that show that between 2022 and 2031, the currently projected cost of healthcare expenditures in the U.S. of $59.4 trillion would dip to $57.6 trillion under the Medicare for All plan. That's how Sanders arrives at his claim that the study shows that Medicare for All would save the American people $2 trillion over a 10-year period. The study's author, however, told us he doesn't think that's realistic. One reason is that Sanders' bill says healthcare providers will be reimbursed for patients at Medicare payment rates, projected by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to be roughly 40% lower than those paid by private insurers. And the study, which used the text of Sanders' bill to guide assumptions, cautions that the assumption is suspect. The report provided an alternative scenario estimate that showed a net increase in healthcare spending. There is a certain amount of guesswork in estimating the cost of something as complicated as the healthcare system. We're not suggesting the assumptions made in the Sanders bill are wrong, but they aren't the assumptions of the Mercatus Center study. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Charles Slaughter learned the value of entrepreneurship from an early age, first as a paperboy growing up in Connecticut, then with a bicycle repair business he started at Yale. Later, he took the passion globally as a field organizer for a microfinance company, Trickle Up. Then came his first successful venture, TravelSmith, a $100 million online clothing supply company for serious global travelers. But his travels also showed him another stark reality: the number of children dying in third world countries from treatable diseases due to lack of access to basic medicine.
On average, in the countries we work, somewhere between 50 and 100 out of 1,000 kids will fail to reach their fifth birth. There's only three or four sort of major causes of this: diarrheal disease, malaria, and pneumonia. What is shocking is that all of those things can be addressed at extremely low cost. But the barrier is effectively delivering what we know works.
Chuck Slaughter speaking in a Skoll Foundation video highlighting his work. He wondered how he could put the power of healing in the hands of villagers themselves, and he realized a successful model already existed.
The challenge is, how can we reinvigorate this idea of door-to-door healthcare, make it both more impactful and financially viable in places where financial resources are extremely limited? I'm thinking about that, and I go, wait a minute, hold the phone. Isn't there a business model that excels at that? And you start to think about Amway and Avon and Tupperware. Further research, I actually went out and enrolled as an Avon lady and tried to learn it from the inside.
After training as an Avon lady himself, he founded Living Goods, a company that sells not makeup, but life-saving essentials like drugs to treat malaria and diarrhea and solar light.
In a sense, what Living Goods does is quite simple. We recruit, train, and support networks of community health promoters who go door to door every day teaching families how to improve their health and wealth, and then making a living by selling high impact health products like simple treatments for malaria and diarrhea, healthy fortified foods, high efficiency cook stoves, solar lights, and water filters.
Sales associates go from home to home in their villages, not just selling the goods, but teaching the families in the entire community how to use these life-saving essentials.
Every agent works as an entrepreneur under the Living Goods brand. We typically partner very closely with a local government. So where we operate, we are the government's community health army. And now, perhaps most importantly, they get a smartphone. And that smartphone has a Living Goods designed application on it that can help them with a guided diagnosis of childhood diseases that enables them to register and support pregnant women and reminds them to follow up with those customers.
There are now Living Good sales associates serving the needs of some 5 million residents through sub-Saharan Africa, and the results are quite impressive. In some cases, infant and child mortality is down 25% in the communities being served.
I think within 10 years' time, it's possible that every community who needs a community health worker can have one to make sure that that kid doesn't die of malaria or pneumonia or something else ridiculously simple that they needn't die of.
This Living Goods district manager from Uganda has seen the transformation of the health of her communities before her very eyes.
Most of the health centers are very far, and these mothers, these fathers do not have access to these health centers. But with the Living Goods, we are always there for them. Anytime they come across you, you are ready, you have the medication, you give the treatment.
Living Goods, a simple grassroots business model, facilitating the distribution of low-cost, life-saving materials, generating income while saving lives and improving the health of communities as well. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.